So we'll be talking about decision arising and quite a profound topic, and there's so many ways to discuss it. And I would love to do it in such a way that you find some relationship to your life. It's not nearly so philosophical a topic. So I think just even at the beginning, how we started off on generating our motivation, it's a very good illustration of dependent arising, because the value of our action, of any action we do, depends upon the motivation in which we do it. Okay. In America, we tend to focus more on the action and on looking good. But actually, the value doesn't depend on how we look, but on what's going on inside of our heart. And so that's why in Buddhist practice, it's stressed so much to constantly cultivate a good motivation. Okay? Because according to our motivation, that's the creation of karma, and that's the result that we attain. So they say if we do an action motivated by the happiness of this life, it's Friday night, nothing good on TV, think I'll go to the Dharma talk, have a little pleasure, then maybe you'll get that. That'll be the result. Motivation is for this life, you're taking your chance, because it might not be such a funny, amusing Dharma talk. You might be a bit better off staying home if you're looking for entertainment and watch TV. Okay. If your motivation for coming here is to be able to have a good rebirth in the future life, then according to that motivation, that result will come from listening to the talk. If your motivation for coming here is to attain liberation, that result will come about from listening to the talk. If your motivation is to attain full enlightenment for the benefit of sentient beings, that result will come. So, we may all get different results from being in the same talk, because it all depends on our different motivations. How often in America do we have the motivation for liberation and enlightenment? How often do we have the motivation for good rebirth? Not so often. Our main motivation is my pleasure right now, ASAP, please. Okay, and so that pleasure may or may not come. And the actions we do with that motivation are like riding on water, nothing sticks. So that's why it's so important to cultivate a Dharma motivation, either aspiring for good rebirth, for liberation, for enlightenment. That's why it takes to deliberately do this at the beginning of the talk. Yeah. So some of you are probably saying, I've heard this before. And Dharma talk, all my teachers, they say cultivate your motivation, aspiring for enlightenment. What are they going to say? Something interesting in the Dharma talk. I have a leech feed already, I'm going to enlighten. Well, really? Do you really want to get enlightened? Do you have a choice between enlightenment and chocolate cake? What do you really choose? Every morning when the alarm goes off, there's a choice between sleeping longer and enlightenment. What do we usually take?
Sleeping
longer. We usually take sleeping longer, don't we? So do we really want to go to cheetah aspiring for enlightenment?
No.
But we try. And so we just keep trying, and we just keep cultivating it. And because things are dependent on arising, if we keep cultivating it, if we keep making it a habit in our mind, then one day it'll be spontaneous. But that doesn't come without effort. It has to come with effort and time and patience. Okay. So dependent on arising is There's two Tibetan words that are often used simultaneously for this. One is tendral, which means dependently related, and the other is tenjung, which means dependently arisen. And The term dependent interaction can refer to a number of different things in Buddhism. One word that's common to all the different Buddhist traditions is the 12 links of dependent arising. Okay? So these were outlined in the Pali scriptures by the Buddha, and the 12 links describe how we are born in cyclic existence, because one link leads to another link, leads to the other one. And by understanding how we take rebirth in cyclic existence, then we, and what causes cyclic existence, then we can also figure out where to cut the causes for cyclic existence. So what links in the process can we intervene to cut the causes for cyclic existence? Okay, so that description of dependent arising is common to Theravada, Mahayana, Vajrayana, all the different Buddhist schools. And it's actually quite an important teaching. And when you really get into it, it makes you a little bit scared, because you see very clearly how we keep taking rebirth, how rebirth happens again and again and again, you know, under the influence of ignorance, afflictions, and karma. And when we really see how much our life is ruled by ignorance, afflictions, and karma, we get a little concerned, not just a little, but a lot. And it's really kind of frightening, you know, because you just think of getting reborn again and again, and it's like, I don't want that. And at that point, then what's born is renunciation, also translated as the determination to be free. Okay, so meditating on that, on dependent arising, the dependent universe of 12 links, brings us to generate the determination to be free. And then that in turn inspires us to realize emptiness, because the realization of emptiness is what cuts the first link of ignorance. When you cut the first link of ignorance, then the creation of karma stops, then the consciousness that this karma seed is planted on gets stopped, and so on. So I don't want to go into the 12 links in depth right now, but just to mention it in that way, and try and get teachings on it. It's an important topic. Another way of talking about dependent arising is in relationship to emptiness and how dependent arising acts as a reason to establish the emptiness of inherent existence. And so this is a way in which it's commonly used in the Tibetan tradition. Actually, somebody once asked His Holiness the Dalai Lama, if Buddhism had a slogan, what would the Buddha's slogan be? And this woman said, dependent arising. So I think that some people made buttons, you know, dependent arising. One of the good team players, so this team motto, dependent arising. Okay, so, you know, in a broad way, dependent arising relates to the whole path, doesn't it? I mean, we just saw there how the dependent leaders in 12 minutes helps us generate the determination to be free. In the motivation, we saw how depending upon the kindness of human beings, we have not only to do everything that's possible in our life. So we see dependence in that way of sentient beings, and that helps us develop love and compassion for them. Okay? If we see the dependent nature of phenomena, it helps us develop the wisdom that realizes emptiness. So they call dependent arising the king of reasons when it comes to the emptiness meditation, which is the emphasis I want to make now. Okay, so the syllogism usually goes, you know, all phenomena are not inherently existent because they're dependently arising. Yeah. Sounds simple, just a few words. It's not so simple. Yeah. What's really interesting, you know, is from the viewpoint of the Prasangika Majjhimika, which is the highest tenet system, that syllogism holds, you know. dependent becomings or dependent arising, they are not inherently existent. They are not truly existent. They don't have their own identifiable, findable essence that you can draw a line around and say, this is it. But what's interesting is in the lower philosophical schools, dependent arising is used as the proof for true existence. The exact opposite from how the present class use it. Okay? And this is because, from the viewpoint of the lower school, if things are dependent, okay, from the point of view of the lower philosophical schools, things are inherently existent. They have their own essence somewhere. Because if they didn't have their own essence, then they wouldn't exist at all. Okay. So for the mental states of some people, yeah, the Buddha taught this view because it was in accord with their capabilities, their mental faculties. Because some people would get very frightened thinking at Balta nihilism, thinking that if things were not truly existent, they didn't exist at all, then the Buddha taught, well, they are truly existent. So these lower philosophical schools say, well, things are dependently arising, there isn't. This is the Buddha slogan, all the Buddhist schools believe in dependent arising. So things are dependent arising. Yeah, they exist. So dependent arising must mean that things exist. And since things inherently exist, they truly exist, then dependent arising proves that things truly exist. Because if they didn't exist dependently, then they wouldn't exist at all. If they didn't exist inherently, they wouldn't exist at all. Okay? So for the lower schools, you know, that syllogism doesn't hold. For them, you know, if it's dependently arisen, it's inherently existent. Meanwhile, for the Prasangika view, it's just the opposite. If it's dependently arisen, it's not inherently existent. So let's look a little bit more at that. You know, why is that so? If something's dependent, then it's not inherently existent. Well, inherent existence means, like I was just saying, that things have their own identifiable of their essence. It means that if you analyze and search for something, you know, what the essence of an object is, what the essence of who we are is, you can be able to find something. There's going to be something you can identify. And when we look, when we say the word I, or whatever your name is, you know, say your name, or imagine somebody else saying your name, there's this feeling of I that comes, isn't there? I, me, I'm here, don't forget me. Yeah. The way that I appears to us is as an inherently existent one. And we assent to that view. Okay. I mean, the view of inherent existence is so ingrained in us that we don't even realize that we have. That everything that appears to our senses even appears inherently existent. And we buy into it. And just the way we conceive of ourselves is a very good example. Because it feels like there's a real person in there, doesn't it? Yeah. Do you doubt that you exist? Oh, I'm here. I'm me. This is me. This is me. This body is here, therefore I am. You know, or Descartes, I think, therefore I am. But somewhere in there, there's a big I, isn't there? And that big I appears very vividly when we're angry. Or when we're attached. Okay? So imagine time when you had a very strong emotion. For example, when you're feeling really emotionally needy. Can you imagine, can you remember a time when you just feel so emotionally needy? I need someone to love me. Okay? There's a very strong feeling of I at that time. Do we ever doubt that we exist the way we appear? No, we just assume that big, strong I is really there. Because that I needs somebody to love it. Or when we're angry, How dare they do that to me? Me?
Me, can you imagine?
The world by which world treats me.
Now,
do we ever doubt that that person, that me, exists the way it appears? No! We're completely convinced there's that me there. And we've got to defend it against this incredibly unappreciative world. You know, that just doesn't recognize how privileged it is to have me in it. Right? Yeah? So, you know, how we conceive of ourselves, how the I, the self, appears to us, is inherently existent. And we just go right along with that. You know, it feels like there's a real thing there. Whenever we see something, it appears like it has its own essence. And we go right along with that. You know, somebody looks out $100 bill and it becomes a home. You know, so interesting. You know, you can see the mind start. I wonder how long I can get that. Who can figure this one? You know? And we take it. Okay? So, we think that $100 bill has some essence and value on its own. Does it? It's a piece of paper. Paper and ink. The only value it has is because we've imputed value onto it. The only way it's become money is because we've imputed money onto it. But do we relate to it that way? We think it has a real inherent value. And in fact, our life depends on that. The more $100 bills we have, the more worthwhile and successful our life is. So America's about it, isn't it? Yeah? If you have money, you're successful. If you don't have money, you're not successful. This is all the vision of inherent existence. Yeah. It's complete rubbish, isn't it? But we buy into it. We buy into it. The vision and the money. We buy into it. Okay? So, all these things appear as if they have their own essence. So they appear to have that independent nature. Inherent existence means independent. It has its own nature. It has its own thingness inside there that makes it what it is and not make, doesn't make it somewhere else. So things appear independent to us. So here we have the Buddhist slogan, the independent arising, and our normal everyday appearance and way of thinking as being independent. They're contradictory, aren't they? Something can't be dependent and independent at the same time. Yeah. They're explicitly contradictory. Yeah. No way that those two can go together. And yet somehow, in our confusion, we say, yes, everything arises dependently, but they're also, they're not independent essence. And this is our confusion as such beings. Okay, so when we really contemplate dependent arising, it helps us, it challenges our usual way of how things appear to us and how we assent to our experience. It's calling all of that into question. Okay? And it makes us really check and analyze. Do things exist in the way that they appear to us? So, the term dependent arising, sometimes it talks about three different meanings of dependent arising. So the first one is needing, and the second one is relying, and the third one is depending. Okay? When we talk about needing, they're referring to cause and effect. Things are dependent. Functioning things, okay, and permanent phenomena depend on this whole system of cause and effect. Nothing comes into existence without a cause. Okay? Not no thing. We thing here means functioning phenomena. Okay? But, and we say, oh yes, you know, my body came into existence with a cause, and it's sperm and egg, and, you know, my mind came into existence. of everything comes into existence with God.
But do we really live our life as we believe that, that we exist due to causes and conditions? Did you ever think, I exist only because the causes of me exist? Think about that one. Do you ever sit back and think, I exist only because the causes of me existed? If those causes didn't exist, I wouldn't exist. Does something in your mind feel a little bit uncomfortable with that? Yeah, what are you talking about if causes don't exist, I don't exist? I exist. I'm here. I'm independent. Don't tell me I'm dependent. I'm independent. I exist no matter what happens. And even this body goes, even this mind goes away, there is a soul. There's a real essence of meanness that goes into the next life. I'm sure of it. Okay? That's our grasping and inherent existence, right there. Yeah. Do you see how our normal, just everyday view completely? We don't really live our lives like we believe that things arise independence upon God's creation. We really think, oh no, there's a me. Yeah. I exist only because the causes of me exist. Then you start thinking, what are the causes of me? What are the causes of me? Well, the body, the mind. What are the causes of the body? Sperm, egg, and all the food we've eaten since then. Okay, this thing here that we cherish so much, that we want to give as much pleasure to as possible, exists only because there's a sperm, an egg, and a pile of food. That's all this body is, folks. And yet, do we relate to it as if it's a sperm, egg, and pile of food? This body's me. It's the source of my pleasure. I don't want to be separated from it ever, ever, ever. And at the time of death, we freak out. It's like, no body? Who am I going to be without a body? Yeah, my body establishes my identity. Okay? But the body just depends on causes, that's all. It's just here because there's causes. You know, different sperm, different egg, different food, different body. Mm-hmm. Our mind. You know, we have human aggregates, human feelings, human discriminations, human volitional factors, human primary consciousnesses. Yeah? These four mental aggregates only exist because the cause of them exists. Yeah? What's the cause of all these aggregates? Well, there's a continuity of clear knowing that goes back to previous lives. But why do we have human aggregates? Because of karma. Because of our actions in our previous lives. Did you ever think that who you are is a result of karma? Do we really think that we're a result of karma? Do we really live our life like we believe in karma? We talk a lot like we believe in karma. But when it comes to a situation in which we could lie and get a little bit of benefit from ourselves, do we believe in karma at that moment? What do we usually choose to do? If we could lie, and be pretty sure we won't get caught, and it'll benefit us, do we usually lie or abstain from lying? We usually lie, don't we? Yeah? I won't get caught. Nobody will know. It's only a little lie. Okay, I took this 5 precepts not to lie, but this is just a little lie, and anyway, I'm practicing the Bodhisattva path, so I can make exceptions to it, because this benefit that I'm getting from lying, I'm getting this benefit for the benefit of all sentient beings. This money that I'm going to get by lying, and my taxes by lying on this and that, I'm going to give it away for the benefit of all sentient beings. Right. Do we really believe in karma?
Do we really live our lives like we believe in karma?
Yeah. Somebody gives you a box of chocolate. You have the choice to offer the chocolate on the altar to the Buddha Dharma Sangha or to keep it. What do we choose to do? Well, you know, we're very good Buddhists. You know what we do? We offer it first. And then when we take it down, we eat it.
Don't we?
We offer it because we don't want to get caught in the act of being too selfish, because we want to look like good Buddhists. Okay. But we definitely want that chocolate. We're not going to give it away. And we're sure glad that it's only a statue of Buddha we're offering to, not the real Buddha. Are you sure we are? Why do we worship this? Okay. So it's very interesting to ask ourselves, do we really believe in karma? You know, do we live our life like we believe in karma? Do we really think of ourselves as just some karmically created bubble? Does that make you feel uncomfortable to say, I am a karmically created bubble? It should make you feel uncomfortable. Does it make you feel uncomfortable? I'm a karmically created bubble. There's something in that that says, no way, I'm not a karmically created bubble. I'm me. Everybody else is a karmically created bubble. Okay. Yeah, because the Buddha talked about things existing only on the level of appearances and things being independent. Everybody else is a karmically created bubble. But me? No, I'm not a karmically created bubble. I exist. Here inherently independently. Okay? So just thinking about cause and effect, you know? Do we really see things as being created by causes? Do we see things as being dependent on causes? Not always. Not always. We talk a lot about it. But, you know, how we live our life doesn't always reflect that view. It's interesting when they talk about this thing of cause and effect. If they talk about like a seed growing into a flower, let's say. Okay? So at the time of the seed, the flower doesn't exist, right? Well, are you sure? Because at the seed is in the process of changing. Yeah, it's maybe we should, instead of flower, maybe we should say sprout, because the sprout comes first after the seed. The flower comes later on. So let's use seed and sprout. When the seed is in the process of transforming into a sprout, we say that the seed is approaching cessation. Okay? Because the seed, when the sprout exists, the seed's not going to exist, right? Because cause and effect don't exist at the same time. So, at the time of the seed exists, but it's approaching cessation. Yeah. Now, the seed is going to become a sprout. So, at the time of the seed, the sprout has got to exist. If it didn't exist, it couldn't be created. If it was a totally, if the sprout were like the mustache on a turtle, or like weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, it'd be totally non-existent. But the sprout isn't totally non-existent. So the sprout exists, and we say at the time of the seed, the sprout is approaching production. So you have these two things. It's like the seed is approaching cessation, and the sprout is approaching production, and at one time those two meet and the seed becomes a sprout. Okay? Now, that sprout that's approaching production, what is it? It exists? Yeah? I mean, we've got to say that sprout exists, because otherwise, if it was non-existent, it couldn't be produced.
But if it exists, why does it need to be produced? Yeah? Which is it? Does it exist or doesn't it exist? If it already exists, why does it need to be produced? If it doesn't exist, how can it be produced? Is it there? Is the sprout there? When the seed is there and the seed's approaching production, is the sprout there? You can find the sprout if you look inside the seed. Can you find the sprout? Is the result there inside the seed waiting to come out somewhere? So where's that sprout? Okay. So we get into this kind of tangle when we accept inherent existence. Yeah, this kind of messed up tangle happens, okay, because of grasping an inherent existence. Because if we think of the sprout as an inherently existent sprout, then if it exists at the time of the seed, because it's, you know, the sprout's approaching production, then we should be able to find it. But there's no sprout there to find at the time of the seed because it hasn't been produced. Okay. So at that point, the sprout exists, but we can see it exists really only by being labeled, doesn't it? Okay? There's a future phenomena. Okay. The future sprout exists now, but the sprout doesn't exist now. The future sprout and the sprout are not the same thing. Okay. We call something the sprout is being produced. Okay. But there's no findable sprout there. We're just labeling the result, you know, of this cause. Because there is an agent that's approaching production. But it's just a merely labeled agent. There's no actual findable sprout there. It's an interesting thing to think about. And you know what it relates to? It relates to this whole topic of predetermination and free will. Yeah? Because we often ask, you know, is there predetermination or free will? And you know how there were like 14 questions that the Buddha didn't answer when he was alive? Not because he didn't know the answer, but because the way the questions were asked, whatever answer you gave would be wrong, because the question was asked from the viewpoint of inherent existence, so that's why the Buddha didn't ask it. Well, that similarly, we have the 15th question. Are things predetermined or is there free will? Okay. The Buddha couldn't answer that because that we asked that question thinking of inherent existence in the same way that we think that there's, you know, if the sprout is approaching production, there must be something findable there. So that's how we think of the result of karma. You do some action, well, there's an inherently existent result out there that you're fated to experience. It's all been predetermined by your karma. Is that true? No. Yeah. And yet a lot of times when you hear people talk about karma, they talk about karma as if it's predetermined. Yeah. You do this thing, you get exactly this result, there's nothing you can do to mediate that result coming. It's almost as if they're thinking there's this inherently existent sprout there already existent at the time of the seed. There's an inherently existent result I'm going to experience as a result of this karma, even though I haven't gotten to the future yet when I'm living that. But that's not how karma ripens, okay? It isn't that things are fated. It's not like there's some concrete future out there that's waiting to happen. You know, as moment by moment passes and we get to the future, like it's all planned out and predetermined. But on the other hand, is there total free will? Could I choose in the next minute to fly to Mars?
No, there's not total free will, you know. The cause haven't been conditioned, haven't been created for me to fly to Mars. Okay, so I don't have total free will. I can't, I wish I could choose to speak Tibetan in the very next moment, but I haven't created the cause this time. So the low second rule is the intellect. Okay, and a few other words. But, you know, so there's not total unbridled predetermination, total unbridled free will either. Yeah? Things arise dependent on causes and conditions. Because they're dependent on causes and conditions, they're not inherently existent. When we ask the question about predetermination, we're talking about inherently existent predetermination. When we talk about free will, we're asking about inherently existent free will. Okay. But there's no inherent existence, so you can't really reply to that question. Okay. Things arise due to causes and conditions. They are not predetermined, but they are not chaotic and random either. There's some, you know, there's a lot to think about in there. So I don't know about you, but my mind always wants to find something solid in there to grab onto. To say, oh yeah, it's dependently arising, but there's this. And, you know, that's my security. Okay? So just to give some thought to causes and conditions and to see how results depend on causes. Okay, also from the causing ego field, what gets really interesting is the result depends upon the cause in order to exist, to come into being. The cause does not depend on the result in order to come into being, because the cause comes first, the result comes after, right? Yeah, so the sprout depends on the seed, because you need the seed before you can have the sprout. But the seed does not depend on the sprout, because the seed comes first. Okay? So just in the system of causes producing results, it goes, you know, from the cause to the result. But when you look at cause and result in a bigger way, okay, how did this seed come to be called a seed? Okay? Let's say we have a, what kind of seed do you want? An apple seed. Okay? So we have an apple seed. How did this apple seed come to be called an apple seed? Okay? Doesn't it depend upon it having the capability to produce apples? Okay? So, the, it being called an apple seed, the cause, depends upon the result, the apple. Okay? It being called an apple seed depends on the result. But the apple seed doesn't depend on the result. Getting what I'm saying? Okay? Same thing as calling something an apple. Okay? It's an apple because it was produced by an apple seed. It wasn't produced by a rose seed or a chili seed. Okay, it was produced by an apple seed. So it being an apple depends upon there being an apple seed. Okay? So you have apple seed and apple in this way of labeling them cause and effect, that in a way that they depend on each other and they become apple seed and apple at the same time simultaneously. When we're talking about how things exist independent upon labels. Okay? So that viewpoint. For example, our parents. Yeah. Let's say you're the first child. Are your parents parents before you came along? No. They only become parents depending upon us. We only become children depending upon them. Okay? So calling something parent and child depends upon that relationship to each other.
But in terms of being produced, the parents come first and the child comes second. Of course, children later become parents. Okay? So are parents and children mutually exclusive? They're not mutually exclusive, so somebody can be both a parent and a child? So somebody can be their own parent? You can be a parent and a child, so you can be your own parent? You can be your own child? Okay? Sometimes these things seem a little bit like word games. It's like, well, no, it's so obvious. But you know, when they put these things to us, what it does is we get tangled in it. Because somehow we're grasping an inherent existence. We're not really thinking of things as existing by being merely labeled. Okay? So it puts us right in front of our grasping. Okay, so that's talking about that first characteristic, which is meeting as one meaning and practicality arising. Okay? Causes producing results. Of course, that refers only to functioning phenomena, impermanent phenomena. Okay? Permanent phenomena do not arise in dependence upon causes because they're permanent. They don't mean. But permanent here doesn't mean eternal, it means unchanging. Okay? So permanent phenomena, like empty space, are like the emptiness of inherent existence, are like true cessation. Okay? So these things that are permanent. I don't ask you to cause the conditions. Okay, so they aren't described as being dependent in terms of this first meaning of dependent arising because they're not depending on causes. So there's a second meaning of dependent arising that includes permanent phenomena, and this is the one that's called what they talk about relying, and this means relying on parts. That things depend upon parts. Things exist independent upon the parts that create them. Okay? So when we say chair, we have this chair here. Okay? The chair exists depending upon the parts, doesn't it? I mean, there's an arm, and there's four legs, and there's a cross piece, and there's a seat, and there's a back. Okay? So you put all these parts together, and then we have a chair. So all phenomena, permanent and impermanent, depend upon their parts. They exist only in dependence upon their parts. Okay? That's the meaning of upreliant. And so in a similar way, it's interesting to think about in terms of ourselves when we say I. I exist only because the parts of me exist. How does that feel? I exist only because the parts of me exist. You know, there's an arm, there's a leg. You get one of these images after a terrorist attack, you know, an arm here, a leg there, a head there, you know, the body completely blown apart, you know, the mind somewhere, who knows where. Yeah. But depending on all these parts being together in a certain arrangement, then the body exists. Without all those, the body doesn't exist. Okay. Same thing for the mind, all the different parts of the mind, all the different moments of mind, all the different aspects of mind. Yeah, we only say the mind exists because all the different parts of the mind, the primary consciousnesses, the mental factors, because all of these things exist. Okay? So things depend on parts. This is also a very interesting thing to play with in your daily life, especially when attachment comes up to something, to dissect it into its parts and ask yourself what it is that you're attached to. Okay. Yeah. You're okay, like a new car. Yeah. You want to get a BMW, let's say. Oh, I want a BMW, I want a BMW, I want a BMW. That's our mantra, you know. You say it faithfully every day. Yeah. More times than the mantra passes to even. Oh, Mama can't be home. We're good if we get our commitments done. But I want to
every one of the BMW. Okay, what's this BMW that we want? Yeah. It's four wheels, axle, an engine, some seats, a hood, yeah, some pistons, what? Yeah, yeah, oh right, it has that one little ornament. Actually, yeah, you want the ornament. You could take the ornament and stick it on the VW, you'd be happy. Yeah. Well, I have a VW. So, you know, but what is this thing that we're so attached to? It's just a bunch of parts, isn't it? Yeah, just a bunch of parts. Somebody delivered all the parts on your front lawn? Do you want that? You know, they stacked up the four tires over here, and then you put an axe on the pistons, and the spark plugs, and, you know, a few seats over there, and, you know, a hood over there, and, you know, it kind of be a mess on your front lawn. You don't want that, do you? You want a BMW. But the BMW is only a compilation of those things, isn't it? So what is this beamer that we're so attached to? What is it? What are we so attached to? Yeah. It's just all these parts. So it's a good meditation to do when there's attachment, you know, coming in the mind. Like this. You know, this chocolate cake. Chocolate cake. What is it? Flour, margarine, sugar. Not very healthy, is it? Chocolate. What is it that we're so attached to in that chocolate cake? You know, people put, set out in front of you, I'll come have chocolate cake with you. And they put a cup of flour here, a cup of butter, some sugar, some unsweetened cocoa. Yeah. They put all that in front of you. Are you attached to chocolate cake in that moment? But that's all the chocolate cake is those things. What are we so attached to? Well, what's really good is when you have a lot of sexual desire, okay? Then you think of the body of the person you're attracted to. Two kidneys, big intestine, small intestine, eyeballs, ears, the skin, pancreas, spleen, bones, muscles, thews, joints. By the time you get done thinking of all the parts of the body of the person that you want to go to bed with, what's happened to your sexual desire? For those kidneys? No, I don't think so. What am I desiring? A big intestine or a small intestine? Oh, neither of them, frankly. Very good meditation to cut back on desire. Dissect something into its parts and really ask ourselves, what is it? Okay. Then, the third term, depending. So this it refers to the third kind, the third meaning of dependent arising, which is the unique prasangika, magamaka life. And here, dependent arising means dependent on the term and the concept. Okay. So, you have all these ingredients, you know, your flour and sugar and unsweetened cocoa and all of that. You mix them together in a certain combination. You bake them in the oven. Yeah. You spread some other stuff that's mostly, what's frosting, sugar and what else? More chocolate and more sugar and more chocolate. And something else that's high in fat mixed in to hold it all together. And you smear that on top of it. And then the mind comes along and looks at it and says, chocolate cake. So you have the basis of designation, which is the parts arranged in a particular order at a particular time. Okay. The basis of designation alone does not make chocolate cake exist. Okay. Independence upon that basis of designation, all those parts arranged in that order at that time, the mind conceives chocolate cake and gives the label chocolate cake upon that. That's how chocolate cake comes into existence. No? Okay. So chocolate cake exists by being labeled independence upon something that is capable of bearing that label, that can function as actual chocolate cake, according to the definition of chocolate cake that we as a society have given to the word chocolate cake, okay? So it depends on, you know, a word, it depends on our mind, it depends on a common definition that all of us have agreed upon, a common meaning of the term chocolate cake, and it depends upon the basis of designation being able to function according to the definition that we've given of chocolate cake. So you know when you go into those shops, what are those shops called, you know, where you get the chocolate cake that looks like real chocolate cake but it's made of plastic? Do you ever have those, you know, the ones you used to give to your high school boyfriend or girlfriend to see how they acted? Didn't you ever do that? Oh my goodness, you missed out on so much fun. You have this plastic ice cream. Yeah, it's plastic ice cream. In fact, they even make it so that it looks like it's slightly melted, and you put it on top of the plastic chocolate cake, and you give it to your high school boyfriend. Well, not usually high school boyfriend, except when it's not a great apple. Then you give it to him. And then you give him a spoon, and he starts to, like, eat the ice cream and the chocolate cake, except the spoon can't go in. Yeah, because it's all plastic. So it looks like chocolate cake. It looks like, you know, chocolate cake a la mode. Yeah. But that basis, you know, the plastic, is not a suitable basis to be called chocolate cake a la mode, because it's not functioning as chocolate cake. You're not going to get any way eating it. It can't function as chocolate cake. It's not going to give you the pleasure and the sugar buzz that real chocolate cake gets you. So things are dependent, but there has to be, you know, some coinciding of our societal definition with the basis of the label. Okay. In other words, we can't just label anything. Okay, I can't call this a grapefruit, you know, because it doesn't function as a grapefruit. Now, before we created the definition for the word grapefruit, you know, before, when grapefruit was just a sound without a meaning, without a definition, at that point I could have called this a grapefruit, because we didn't have a definition for grapefruit, a sound, grapefruit, the term grapefruit at that point. But once we have a dish, a commonly agreed upon definition, then we can't call this a grapefruit anymore. So we can't label anything upon anything and just think that that makes it in. What's quite interesting, you know, we see how things exist by being merely labeled. A lot of our conflict in society is fighting over what label to give to something. Yeah. We don't see it as a conflict of labels. We see it as a conflict of what a bad object is, because we don't see the basis of designation and the designating mind and the term as being separate. We think the object is the basis of the designation. That's the view of inherent existence. Okay? In other words, this isn't just called a watch, it is a watch. Okay. So we look at things, you know, this is this, not it's called this. It's very interesting to go through the day and look at everything and say, I'm sitting in something that's called a chair. the I, you know, the I, which is, how do you say it? The body and mind, which is merely labeled I, is sitting in this thing called a chair. That sounds different than I'm sitting in a chair, doesn't it? I'm sitting in a chair. No. The body and mind upon which we've labeled I is doing an action that we've labeled sitting in relationship to something that we call a chair. So it's not I'm sitting in a chair. But we confuse the basis of the designation and the designated object, and we think they're the same thing. Okay, they're not. Things exist independent upon the mind and the label, but they are not the mind and the label. Okay. So what I was saying about a lot of our conflicts depend upon, we're arguing about labels. Okay? This became so clear to me a number of years ago. I was in Israel, and I've been going there to teach for several years in a row, and we did one retreat in the Negev Desert. There was a kibbutz right on the, which border was it? The Jordanian border. Okay, so kibbutz on the Jordanian border where we did our retreat. And the, what we turned into the meditation hall was like, you know, a 30-second walk from this fence. Okay, so there's this fence in the middle of the desert, mind you. Yeah. There's sand on this side and there's sand on that side. And there's a fence in the middle of the sand. And there's a little kind of no man's land there where the sand is raked in a certain way, because then if anybody walks on it, God damn. Yeah. And people are willing to kill each other, depending upon whether how, where that fence is placed in the middle of the sand. Whether that sand is my sand or that sand is your sand. Whether we call that sand Israel or we call that sand Jordan. Okay? It's quite amazing when we think of the number of wars that have been fought in human history over what label to give to a piece of land. Yeah. It's dirt. The same dirt that we sweep out of our house because it makes our house dirty. Suddenly becomes, you know, this inherently existent object that's tied to an inherently existent need that I need in order to survive, and I'm going to kill somebody if they try and label this land other than how I think it should be labeled. Quite amazing, isn't it? Yeah? Quite amazing. And, you know, so many things. We're just arguing over labels. When you go to small claims court, okay? Or even big claims court. Yeah? People, you know, I'm suing you for $1 million or whatever. We're just arguing over the label that gets attached to that money. Whether we label that money mine or yours. And of course, both parties want to label it mine. But from the point of view of John over here, Susan is other. So John is I and Susan is you. From Susan's viewpoint, Susan is I and John is you. So they both say I is belongs to me. Okay. But me has totally different bases of designation. Two bases, doesn't it? One is this body and mine, and one is this body and mine. But they both use the term me. Quite interesting. Are you you or are you me? From the point of John, Susan's you. From the point of Susan, Susan's me. Are you me or am I other? Okay. So which label are we going to give to this money? Are we going to label it mine, or are we going to label it yours? That's all the court battle is about. Okay? When you have a criminal case, now, is this going to be manslaughter? Is it going to be second degree murder? Is it going to be first degree murder? Yeah. The whole trial is just fighting over what label to call it. That's all it is what label to call it. Quite amazing when you think about it. Yeah. We work so hard to get a degree. We want to call ourselves so-and-so BA, so-and-so MA, so-and-so PhD. It's a title, isn't it? It's a label. But boy, we want it. And we're going to work real hard to get it. Just a label. That's all. Okay? The label has some commonly agreed upon definition. But it's still just a label. When you have symptoms of some, you know, you're not feeling well and you go to the doctor, yeah. If the doctor comes back and gives one label to your symptoms, you might feel relieved. If he gives another label to your symptoms, you freak out. Does it change what the symptoms are? No, the symptoms are just symptoms. But we hear the word cancer is a real good one, isn't it? Because we all freak out the C word. Cancer! You know? As if there's inherently existent cancer. Where are you going to find inherently existent cancer? What is the cancer? It's just an accumulation of symptoms that we happen to give the label cancer to. That's all it is. You know? What's AIDS? AIDS. It's a bunch of symptoms that we've given a name to and created a disease. But we think there's an inherently existent AIDS. Nobody wants that. Okay, there's no inherently existent AIDS. Yeah? It's just a bunch of symptoms that we, for shorthand, call AIDS. If you list out the symptoms, you don't get freaked out. If you give it the label AIDS, you get freaked out. Has the thing changed at all? No. Okay? Why do we freak out? Because we're grasping at inherent existence. And we're not realizing that AIDS exists by being merely dependent upon certain concepts. We're not realizing that cancer exists by being merely dependent on certain concepts. Instead, we think that there is a thing that is it. So, yeah, we relate to the terms AIDS and cancer as if there's something inherently existent there, but there's only a collection of symptoms upon which we've given that label. Yeah. Doesn't it change your whole feeling about hearing those words? So this way of looking at dependence as being dependent upon a base and a label can be so freeing in our mind when we're able to separate the basis of designation from the designated object and see that those two things aren't the same. Okay. Then we see that the basis of designation is actually empty of an inherently existent object. It's empty of being an inherently existent object. There's no AIDS there in that collection. There's no inherently existent AIDS there in that collection of symptoms. There's no AIDS there. Yeah. There's no cancer there in that collection of symptoms. AIDS, cancer, kidney failure, whatever it is, hepatitis. It exists only by being labeled independence upon the basis of designation. Does that give you a different feeling about diseases? Does it make you less afraid of getting sick? Yeah, it makes us much less afraid, doesn't it? And it makes dealing with the illness seem kind of plausible. There's just a bunch of symptoms, you know, or there's just a bunch of parts. There's just a bunch of cells there. That's all. It's just a bunch of cells doing what this bunch of cells do. That's all. It's not like So seeing the dependent arising of things helps us to see that they don't have an inherent nature, and seeing that there's no inherent nature helps our mind relax. Okay, that's the purpose of realizing emptiness. That's the purpose of realizing dependent arising. Okay? So dependent arising is actually set to counteract both extremes. When we talk about, you know, realizing reality of conventional ultimate, there's two extremes that we tend to call. Either the extreme of reification, there's truly existent things with a, your own identifiable essence and core, or there's not. Those are the two extremes that we go to. Neither one of them exists. So when we talk about, you know, things are not inherently existent because they're dependent arising, then we're eliminating the extreme of reification, making things into solid, concrete things, solid age, solid me, solid my country, yeah, solid whatever, you know, my problem. Okay. So, but dependent arising keeps us from reifying things. Okay. But dependent arising also prevents us from going to the extreme of saying that they don't exist at all. Because they do exist. Yeah. They arise dependently, therefore they exist. Okay. So dependent arising counteracts extreme reification and extreme realism. So that's why it's said to be the human reasons, because it counteracts. If you understand dependent arising correctly, it counteracts the possible extremes that you can go to in your analysis. Okay? So this is from the Prasangika view. So we can see here that kind of that's what I said at the beginning, that the lower schools who say, you know, things are dependent arising, therefore they inherently exist. Because if they don't inherently exist, they don't exist at all. They're stuck in the two extremes, that either something inherently exists or it's totally non-existent. So they don't have the correct view of dependent arising. They aren't able to use it to see the middle way. And by the way, the middle way isn't that it's half inherently existent and it's half non-existent. That's not the middle way. Okay? We tend to think of middle as, you know, part this and part that. It's the middle way because it's neither of them. Yeah, it's like a triangle. It's not halfway between the two points. It's outside of the whole paradigm. So that's why dependent arising is, you know, the Buddhist slogan and why it's such a valuable thing to try and understand. And it's something that we can train our mind to understand in just in our regular life. You know, train our mind when we see things to think of them as existing only because the causes exist. Yeah. This mess I'm in exists only because the causes exist. Or the mess I'm in exists only because its parts exist. And actually, it's only a mess because I'm calling it a mess. It isn't an inherently existing mess. It could also be an opportunity. It could be a challenge. Yeah. I could label it a bunch of different things. And, you know, and that base could support different labels. It's fine. You don't have to see it as an inherently existent mess. Okay? So these things, they may sound kind of philosophical when we talk about them, but they're actually very applicable to our daily life in really training our mind to not just go along with how things appear to us, but to really question how they appear and investigate how they appear. And when we do that kind of analysis, we see that they're empty in their existence. And then when, after we do the analysis, when those things still appear, we realize that there's an appearance there, but they don't exist the way they appear. Because they appear truly existent, but they aren't. So that's the meaning of saying that they're like illusions. Okay? They aren't illusions. We can't say phenomena are illusions. Okay. If they were illusions, they wouldn't exist at all. Okay. But they're like illusions in that they appear to exist one way but don't exist that way. Okay. So this gets into the whole discussion of the two truths. It gets into a lot more. But I think that's maybe enough for one evening. Some of you are probably thinking that it's more than enough.